On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush's job approval rating is dropping like a stone. The 88% in 9/11's aftermath is ancient history. The 50% at his reelection, long gone. By the middle of this week, Bush's rating had plummeted to his father's low of 31%, the lowest presidential showing in half a century, but for Jimmy Carter and Richard Nixon. And today, the Wall Street Journal publishes a poll finding Americans give George W. Bush an approval rating of only 29%. The Republican Congress scores even lower. Huge issues are raging, and Bush still has nearly 1,000 days to govern. How will he do it? Up next on Point, a presidency in trouble and Bush's last 1,000 days. We will spend this hour trying to drill into the heart of the Bush malaise with John Fund of the Wall Street Journal, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution, and our own Jack Beatty. But first, joining me from Washington is Ken Walsh. He's chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
You've followed this man, George W. Bush, for a long time. Did he ever think he'd come to this pass as low as, lower than his father's lowest ratings?
Well, that's very true. I've covered the White House since 1986, and I've seen lots of ups and downs and roller coaster rides, but this one is just a continual slide. And as you say, the startling information today is this 29% approval rating in the Harris poll that's being talked about around Washington. That's getting into his not only historic lows for Bush, but historic lows for any president. I think Harry Truman and Carter, Jimmy Carter, and Richard Nixon might have been a touch lower than that, but this is getting to the point where it could be, if it keeps going like this, the lowest presidential job approval rating in history.
What are the biggest pieces dragging this guy down? I mean, we listed a bunch of them, but how do you prioritize? What's hitting Bush? Is it the issues? Is it his own style of leading, of governing, that's coming back to bite him? How do you interpret it?
I think it's a number of things. I think that the Iraq has to be at the top of the list, though, the Iraq war. I think the erosion of support for the war, the feeling that while Americans, most Americans, for support of the entry into the war, now the occupation has gone on for a long time now, that the Americans are still being killed. It's very messy, and there's a sense that the administration really doesn't know how to get out of there. And I think that's at the heart of Bush's problems. But there's other things. I mean, any president has trouble with gasoline prices when they get very high. And presidents can't do anything about them, really, when they get to that point. It's really too late. And any president who's dealt with that, from Carter to Nixon and others, have had that problem. But I think there's another issue, and that's that President Bush is really not on the same wavelength of most Americans on a lot of his policies. Ronald Reagan was in that category in many ways, too, but Reagan had a way of reassuring the country that his optimism would prevail and that things would go well, and he benefited from some international events, such as the rise of Mikhail Gorbachev as a partner strategically with the United States. Bush is not getting that. He's just having one problem after another, and many of the Republican strategists I talk to say that what he needs is a big victory, or at least a sense that he can give to the country that things will get better and he has a handle on improving the life of the country and the war in Iraq. And so far, we haven't seen that.
Reagan's low point came in his first term, January 1983. Here Bush is well into his second term now, but still with a long time to go. Is Washington manageable? Are these big issues, crises, any number of them, manageable when a president has this low an approval rating, or does it matter?
I think that, that's the subject we're going through in Washington now. At the top of the show, you mentioned the Harry Truman parallel, and
yes.
Bush appears to be wedded to that notion that if he's not given credit for what he's doing in his own time, history will vindicate him, and that Harry Truman's model will prevail. Truman, of course, was unpopular at the end of his presidency, but history has redeemed him in many ways as a guy who took the long view. That's where Bush is now. He's thinking that he's been reelected. They really can't touch him unless the Democrats take over Congress, and there's an extraordinary move toward impeachment, which I don't see right now. But basically, Bush is wedded to this idea that he'll stick to his guns and history will redeem him.
Credit in heaven, in a way, but he's got a long road to go before he's out of the Oval Office and a lot of
he
governing
does.
To
well,
do.
Right, as you say, he's got more time left, almost more time than John Kennedy had in his whole presidency left. That's a long time to try to recover from this. But once presidents get this deep in the trough, it's often very, very difficult for them to pull out.
Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We are joined now from Washington by E.J. Dionne, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, columnist for the Washington Post, Writers Group, teaches public policy at Georgetown University. E.J., thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
John Fund is with us from New York, columnist for the Wall Street Journal. John, thanks very much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly, is with us. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, gentlemen.
John Fund, first to you. Is this a Harry Truman? How do you read these polls? I mean, I'm looking back here. If he's down to 29% now, as Harris and your WallStreetJournal.com would had it, he's right next to Jimmy Carter, just a couple of points from Nixon. Not where Harry Truman was at 22% in February 1952, but way down there. Is this a president waiting to be redeemed decades from now?
I'll leave that to the historians. I'll simply say that given the strength of the economy, such numbers are astonishing and really speak to much deeper angst and anxiety among the American people than would normally be indicated. It used to be that if you got the economy right, and leaving aside the high gas prices, you know, you were in pretty good shape. Now, I'll make a flat prediction.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if any future president will really want a second term, because all second terms seem to end up badly. I'll make a prediction that whether it's John McCain or some third-party presidential candidate, that somebody in 2008 is going to campaign on the theme, I'll only run for one term, I'll clean up the mess, I won't worry about re-election, because after all, the second terms always seem to turn out badly.
They won't even want the second term if it were handed to them on a silver platter. E.J. Dionne, how do you read this? If this were a parliamentary system, George Bush would be on his way out, but we are not. That's not the way it works here. How do you govern when you've got 29% and still dropping, apparently?
First, I find John's idea intriguing, the kind of Cincinnatus approach to the presidency. And I could actually see somebody doing that. The only problem is would the first term then become the second term?
You're a lame duck forever.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the core problem here is that the president's strength in public opinion was always rooted in two things. One is trust, and the other is this feeling that Americans used to have that there was strong, competent leadership there. When the president's opponents would make fun of him for speaking in sometimes odd ways with odd syntax, the reaction of a lot of Americans was, look, he's a plain-spoken guy and we can believe him. And I think a whole lot that has happened over the last year and a half, 2 years has undercut that. And once you lose that, it's very hard for a president to climb out of his difficulties, because when he starts making a case for himself, people just don't believe it. And then I think the whole idea of strong, competent leadership went out the window with what happened in Hurricane Katrina. Two other quick things.
Yes.
I think the foundations of this presidency were already endangered before Katrina. And without going into details, I think picking Social Security privatization, partial privatization, as his key theme for the second term was a mistake, partly because he had to talk down the economy in order to make the case for that there was a crisis in Social Security. The Terry Schiavo incident, I think, is underrated as having a kind of – as beginning to shake the public's confidence in conservative government in Washington. And then, obviously, the deterioration in Iraq and the amount of attention the Plame case was getting back in August of last year, all that had weakened the foundations before Katrina came. In terms of Harry Truman, it's very clear the president himself is looking to the Harry Truman metaphor. Why did Truman go up in public esteem? Well, he put together the architecture that helped create America's strong leadership role in the world. He built toward a long period of prosperity and ultimately toward victory in the Cold War. I think the question for Bush is whether the policies he's put in place now will have all those beneficial effects in the long run. Obviously, his opponents these days are skeptical of that.
Jack Beatty, we're going to have to wait a long time, as John Fund says, to figure out whether this is a Harry Truman or not. Clearly, most Americans would not predict that today, given their approval rating. The big difference is we're sitting here looking at many, many more days and weeks and months and years of George Bush in the White House leading this country with at least for the moment, these incredibly low support numbers.
Yes, and we have to wonder, what is he going to do to reverse them, and what pressures will be brought on him through his party to get a better poll rating? And, you know, my grave fear is that he will precipitate a war with Iran, and that the window of that may even be as close as this fall with the elections. You say, well, presidents don't do things like that. Well, the Pentagon Papers, Bush's own experience, show again and again that they do, that when political survival is at stake, they take what seems to me to be reckless positions, and this one would be, even though the Iranians are certainly giving him every provocation. And secondly, that would give him, presumably that would give him some kind of rise in the poll. So I'm just really worried about that. But the other thing is, he can really, even with this 29, 24, who knows how low he'll go, he can make tremendously consequential decisions.
John Fund says we may not see presidents running for a second term again. One decided not to do that in 1968. Here's Lyndon B. Johnson, March 31st of that year, with his startling announcement from the Oval Office.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
LBJ, 1968, John Fund, President Bush is already in for a second term. How do you think he and his advisors will attempt to maneuver out of this hole on the polls, or is it going to be polls be damned? We'll do what we want to do here.
Well, in part, he's, of course, hostage to events in Iraq, which are not entirely under his control, and that is the most important reason dragging down his approval ratings. But the most salient political thing he can do now, since Congress is now cleaning up business, is to look towards the November elections and avoid a potential disaster. At least a start was made this week as the Senate and the House both passed extensions of the Bush tax cuts, which, given the rush of revenue that's flowing into the federal government, I think it's fair to say that they did prompt business investment, and despite high gas prices, they certainly have kept the economy afloat. But the president also has to do things to, I think, avoid the single thing that leads to midterm disasters for parties, and that is low morale in their own base, voters. The 1974 disaster after Watergate that the Republicans suffered occurred not because more people became Democrats, but because 10% of Republicans decided not to vote after the Richard Nixon disaster. And the president has to reconnect with his base voters and convince them that there's a reason for them to vote Republican. I think that it's very difficult to get your groove back if you're dancing to somebody else's beat. And the president's mixed messages on things like government spending and, for a certain part of the base, immigration, have confused Republican voters and made them wonder, you know, is there more than 5 cents worth of difference between the two political parties?
But can he get back there? I mean, the government spending, that's pretty well done. The deficit numbers, he's not going to turn those around.
It's never done because the Senate has just passed an emergency spending bill, which is filled with $16 billion of very marginal non-emergency spending. The president has said he's going to veto it. Now, he has claimed that he was going to veto lots of other legislation and never did. This is the president who has gone 5.5 years without vetoing a single bill. He has to either veto this or tell the House leaders to stop it, because at that point, I think then you enter into a dangerous zone where you've lost all credibility. And the issues that E.J. Dionne mentioned, the trust and the competence, if you can't find something to veto after you've drawn a line in the sand, then people question whether or not you're president or a weather vane.
E.J. Dionne, the president's base, the numbers not good there either, not nearly as bad as on the other side of the ledger, but definitely falling. Is that his redemption? Can he get that base back?
Well, I think what John's comments are revealing and important because they reflect a desire on the part of a lot of conservatives to distance themselves from parts of the Bush and the Republican Congress's legacy. There was a very important piece, I thought, in the National Review, a conservative magazine by Cato Byrne and Rich Lowry, really taking on the Republican Congress. When one side of the argument really starts to have this kind of internecine warfare, it's a real problem for them. I think the other problem that the president and conservatives face is the core contradiction of what they've been trying to do here. You know, the deficit didn't rise because President Bush spent a whole lot of money on new social welfare programs, with the exception, of course, of the prescription drug benefit under Medicare. Many would say that's not welfare, but it is a social program. But a lot of this is increased defense spending, the war in Iraq, increased spending on Homeland Security. You can't do all that stuff. You can't fight a war and cut taxes at the same time without having a big fiscal problem. There was a very interesting article by Jonathan Rauch, my colleague here at Brookings, where he quoted Bill Niskanen, who's head of the Cato Institute, not somebody with my own politics, but Niskanen made a very important point. The conservatives have sort of lived on this idea of starve the beast, that if you cut taxes, eventually government spending will go down.
Right.
And Niskanen says the evidence is actually quite the reverse, that when you cut taxes and spend money, you're giving people government at a discount. And when you give people something at a discount, you tend to get more of it. And so if the starve the beast idea really doesn't work, conservatives really have to go back to the drawing boards. And I think that President Bush's term will be an object lesson that cutting taxes does not lead to smaller government.
Mm, President Bush in Orlando, Florida, trying to get more seniors signed up for that prescription drug coverage, sat down with the Sun Sentinel newspaper in Orlando, and conceding, he said that a lot of these problems, quoting him, have caused Americans to really take a look at the future and wonder whether or not it's as good as they want it to be. I understand that, but that fear about the future seems to be hitting his poll numbers quite directly. A lot of listeners want to join us. Let me turn to them. Valerie's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Valerie. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you think, Valerie?
I think that a presidency is not a popularity contest. And I think that the media has turned it into that. When I look at President Bush, I see a person who is a moral person who, when he makes decisions, they're very deliberate, in my opinion. And I think he's been a great president. I voted for him. I voted for him twice. And I, and you know, if I compare the way his presidency versus, say, Clinton's, who I feel had no moral, sort of no moral compass, and actually did live by the polls, I just feel a lot more secure, and I feel America is a lot more safe having Bush's, you know, steering the boat, so to speak.
And what do you make of the fact, I mean, Clinton at this point in his presidency had two or three times George Bush's rating, 64-65% approval rating. Do you think Americans are, your fellow Americans who are putting George Bush so much lower are, what, are they blind?
It's not a popularity contest. It's not a popularity contest. And sometimes,
but it's a democracy. They're supposed to sort of look and have an opinion about how he's doing.
Well, you have, that's why you have elections every four years, not every day.
Yep.
So, sometimes presidents have to do things that are right for the country in the long term versus short. In the short term, they're difficult for the public to understand.
Valerie, we've got it. Jack Beatty, Valerie still sees President Bush as a moral compass, you know, standing in trouble here, but standing anyway.
Well, that's how the president wants to be seen. The trouble is the evidence on the other side of that proposition mounts every day. The president has a predilection for not telling the truth. His party and his administration is full of people who make that a habit. That's not moral. The president's, what we now know about the war, the eagerness with which he went to war, the celerity of the whole thing, his not asking people what they thought about it. According to Bob Woodward's book, he didn't think he had to ask Rumsfeld or Powell about whether it was a good idea to go to war. Is that the action of a moral man? It just seems to me that at this character level, Bush is having trouble. And it isn't just, you know, whether he's a good person or not. It's also, what about that character? I mean, he's one of the first presidents, really since Grant, if you think about it, whose life was a history before he became president, pretty much of failure. And not just of failure, but of upward failure. The president would fail and his father would bail him out with a better position. He was elected governor of Texas. But, you know, more people reported to Howard Dean in Vermont than to him in Texas. And this habit of failure, the characterological mix of things that produced those failures for him consistently, that's dogged him. That's with him now. And that is a sort of like a built-in time bomb in the guy that he just has a sort of tropism toward not doing things right, toward messing up, partly because again and again he would mess up and he would get promoted.
John Fund, what do you say to that? Well, there's a character issue at work here. Valerie says she's all for the man. Jack says, well, look at the results. He's failed upwardly. His groove is really a groove of messing up, and that's still the groove he's in.
Well, it's certainly true that the presidency is not a popularity contest, but you can only pass legislation in Congress if you have approval ratings that give your own party confidence that they can survive at the polls. And at the low 30s, which is the weighted average of all the polls, Republicans in Congress don't have that confidence level. That's why a president does suffer if approval ratings fall below a certain point. As for Jack's comments, you know, I think it's always dangerous for journalists to enter the realm of psychological character analysis. And he may be right, he may be wrong, but I think that the American people are operating on much more fundamental levels. They're not trying to figure out George Bush's psyche. They are very upset, not just at the President Bush, but frankly, a lot of the institutions of our government. I have never seen the country itself do so well. You know, millions of people getting up every day and accomplishing amazing things, the economy doing as well as it does, and the level of cynicism, anger, and frustration is reaching levels, well, we haven't seen them since 1994, when, of course, we had an incredible, you know, wave in Congress.
Right.
And that's the fear that a lot of Republicans have, that the cynicism has left, has reached anti-incumbent tidal wave proportions.
And Bush with 29%. Congress, if I read the Harris poll in the WallStreetJournal.com correctly, Congress at 18% approval rating. You can't get much lower. EJ?
Well, first, I want to salute Valerie's courage. I am from Fall River, Massachusetts, down the road from Providence. That is one of the most Democratic parts of the country. And even though I don't agree with her, I admire anyone courageous enough to hold a minority view like that. I think the trouble is that lots more Americans believed exactly what Valerie said 2 years ago than believe it now. And so for a lot of them, the evidence has shifted the other way. And I think on Iraq, the biggest problem for the president is the following, that when the administration was making the case for war, I believe they really did believe that this was not going to be as difficult as it turned out to be. I think they really did believe that we could get by on that small number of troops. And so Americans look at this war now, several years later, and say it wasn't supposed to be like this. Mm. They, the administration, told us it would be different, that it would be better than this. And I think that really undercuts the president's credibility in making a case on Iraq or anything else.
Not to mention Iran, if it comes to that. Freddie's calling from Nashville. Hi, Freddie. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about an issue that has kind of fallen off the radar in terms of political and media terms, which is something that was specifically done by Republicans in Karl Rove's strategy back in 2002, which was this idea of a culture of fear. In the world after 9/11, the Republicans specifically ran on national security issues, and I know that Katrina is really considered kind of a watershed moment in terms of Bush's confidence as a governor, but I think the trust issue was really breached with the Dubai Ports World deal earlier this year. That was really the point in the polls when things started to go south, and it really also weakened him at the congressional level, because at that time, prior to that, Republicans in Congress were able to stick very close by the president's message on national security issues. But as soon as this issue comes up, which is part trade but also part foreign policy, with a country that was one of three to recognize the Taliban, it immediately started to allow Republicans not to have to be afraid of objecting to the president's goal.
So how do you read that, Freddie? Do you see the culture of fear? Has that run out of gas? Americans, you know, they're no longer propelled by that culture, or there's a sense that, yes, there are threats, but the Bush administration was not serious about confronting them?
Well, I think we're going to see that how that happens in 2006, because at this point, they have run out of steam in terms of, prior to going into Iraq, there were a majority of Americans who believed that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime had close ties. I mean, that's what the polls indicated before.
Yeah, we saw it then, and now you're saying just not the same oomph there. Freddie, thanks for your call from Nashville. John Fund, how about the culture of fear? Is that out of gas as something to push? And what about the Iran war potential that Jack raises as a way potentially for Bush to dig himself out of a hole?
Well, the practical realities of this are that we cannot attack Iran, I think, very readily without expecting massive retaliation. This is a country that has financed and had dealings with suicide bombers for a generation. any attack on Iran would not have any assurance we would get every part of their nuclear capability. And at the same time, I'm sure that it would unleash a wave of suicide bombers.
Does that mean Bush would not do it?
I can't tell you because I'm in the councils of government, but military strategists say that this is about as risky as you can possibly get, and I think we don't want to overhype the possibility of this. The other thing I would simply say is, you know, I certainly have been supportive of much of the Iraq war effort. However, I'll have to concede this. Any leader of Iran, even a democratic leader, if the world superpower had invaded the next-door country and put in 140,000 troops with the prospect of permanent military bases, any leader of Iran, including the crazed religious mullahs who run the place, would probably say, you know, as an insurance policy, why shouldn't I get the bomb? Look what just happened to Saddam Hussein.
So go out and grab it right now. EJ, what about that war prospect and the culture of fear that Freddie raises? Do you think Bush could hit those organ pedals again here?
I think it's very hard to play the same song twice, to stick with the musical metaphor, especially after what happened in Iraq. Jack's fear that the president might go into a war partly for political reasons, I know, is widespread. I just heard almost the same exact argument yesterday from another critic of the president. I think going after Iran right now is exceedingly difficult, as John suggested. And I think that if the president did make the case for war, there would be much more skepticism, not only on the part of the Democratic Party, but I also think on the part of some Republicans, people who were quietly critical of the president on Iraq in his own party or raised questions, people like Chuck Hagel, the senator from Nebraska, or Richard Lugar, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, I think would be much more vocal this time. And I'm not sure the administration actually wants this war. In terms of the culture of fear, when the caller put the Dubai ports deal on the table, which we hadn't even mentioned, you know the president's in trouble when we just keep having to add things to the list of reasons of why he is in trouble.
Let's listen for a moment to the White House Correspondents' Dinner not so many days ago. Here was Stephen Colbert, host of the Colbert Report on Comedy Central, urging the president to ignore his naysayers.
Don't pay attention to the approval ratings that say that 68% of Americans disapprove of the job this man is doing. I ask you this, does that not also logically mean that 68% approve of the job he's not doing? Think about it. The greatest thing about this man is he's steady. You know where he stands. He believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday. No matter what happened Tuesday. Events can change. This man's beliefs never will.
Comedy Central's Colbert at work there. Funny, but not funny. We're at 800-423-TALK. Murray's calling from Hughesville, Maryland. Hi, Murray. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Yeah. You know, my one question is, we know that the Founding Fathers created the three branches of government in an effort to create checks and balances. Mm-hmm. With this latest news on NPR this morning, where the NSA refused the Justice Department the secret access that they needed to do the investigation.
So to shut down the internal investigation of that program, yes?
Exactly. If both of those agencies are under the executive branch, where are the checks now? I mean, who's checking the president?
It's a great question. Let's pick it up. John Fund, what do you think about this issue of executive power as exercised by this president? And here we have the NSA issue. Love to hear what you think about that. But also, a president exercising extraordinary power at a time when he's got extraordinarily low public support.
Well, I confess I did not hear the NPR report this morning, so I'm not going to comment on that. On the whole issue of the NSA wiretaps, I certainly think congressional oversight is necessary, but I wonder where in the world it was, because this exact same program was reported in the New York Times last Christmas Eve in great detail. And
you're talking about the USA Today news you're saying was already out there months ago?
You go to the New York Times of December 24th, and you will find this exact story. Now, obviously, members of Congress should have asked questions between December and now, and you wonder, where's Congress doing during this? I would also point out, back in 1999, the New York Times reported that the Clinton administration had a vast program in which, quote, thousands of software monitoring programs are constantly tracking computer activities, looking for illegal acts and data mining, unquote. I think what we have to do before we become hysterical is understand there's a difference between eavesdropping, which is listening into conversations, and data mining, which is going through numbers in a computer sequence, trying to pick out patterns, and trying to figure out if those patterns mean anything, and not keeping the information for permanent use. Clearly, congressional oversight is dictated here. I wish it had started in December.
But how about honesty? I mean, Bush said there was nothing domestic going on when this first came out, and now it clearly is domestic. It's not the same program being talked about before.
No, it's
clearly domestic.
In December, the New York Times story was all about the domestic data mining.
But the big story that everybody was talking about was the tapping, and he said that is of outgoing calls, calls going abroad. And, of course, that's technically correct, but then we have here, in the Times story, as you would have it, also in USA Today, purely domestic sort of looking in.
No. Data mining is not looking in. Data mining.
Well, it depends how you define it. I mean, you're tracking.
Data mining is going through numbers, trying to detect a pattern.
Yeah.
Certain numbers calling certain other numbers over a given period of time. Are there patterns there? Data mining is a very specific term. It is not eavesdropping.
Understood. But let me ask you about this bigger picture here, where this presidency has been very forthright about wanting to expand the power of the executive. Now we have it having done that in ways that are pushing lines all over the place, have even very prominent Republicans concerned, and yet their support is so low. Is there a contradiction here that bothers you, John Fund, as a conservative, to have a very unpopular president exercising extraordinary authority on the nickel of the White House?
I would be actually more worried about an extremely popular president trying to expand executive authority, because that's the one you get a real demagogue. It's that kind of thing where you get a real threats to civil liberties. I think that we should.
I know what you mean, but that sounds a little bit like the Colbert analysis at the same time.
No, I think we should always have oversight over the executive. I think one of the great failures of Congress over the last 6 years has been the Republican Congress, largely because of intimidation over the fact that 9/11 happened and we became very much concerned with the war on terror, has not exercised sufficient oversight, both in domestic and in foreign policy terms. But at the same time, I think we have to step back and realize that, you know, there was a famous Meet the Press broadcast a few months ago over the whole thing about the international tapping of the conversations between alleged terrorists. You had Jane Harman, you had Tom Daschle, you had a whole bunch of people,
Democrats
on there,
right in there,
who had
yep.
been briefed on those programs. They said, you know, we were told about them and we need to go back and look at them, and they said they would go back and ask questions. Well, I have to tell you, if that program was such an egregious violation of civil liberties, where is the Democratic legislation that has been introduced in Congress to restrict it? I think.
But we've got Arlen Specter and Republicans speaking up here as well.
Democratic legislation that has been introduced to restrict the president's tapping ability on the international phone calls.
Yeah, but you're talking politics there, aren't you? Not really separation of powers. E.J. Dionne, how do you see this issue of executive authority?
Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear John saying that the Republican Congress has not done very much oversight of this administration, which is entirely true, which is why divided government has become very popular, which in turn is why Democrats are doing very well in the polls for this fall's congressional elections. On the wiretapping business and the data mining, two things. Jay Rockefeller, who was the ranking Democrat on intelligence, or I guess the co-chair, however that committee is structured, wrote a letter that he sort of put aside and didn't release publicly at the time because all of this was secret and he didn't want to violate the law. But he expressed a lot of doubts about this program the moment he heard about it and finally released this letter when everyone was saying, well, gee, the Democrats didn't say anything. Well, he wanted to say something and felt he was constrained by the law from saying it, but he put it on the record. And I think, Tom, you hit on something very important. I think one of the ways this story is going to play out is whether the president had accurately described this when he was defending it last year. My colleague Gene Robinson in this morning's Post, the president said his terrorist surveillance program targeted international communications in which at least one party was overseas and then only when at least one party was suspected of some terrorist involvement. Now, that sure didn't sound like this data mining operation that we hear now. And so I think the president really is going to have to clarify what exactly is he saying now compared to what he said earlier.
Of course, John and others are pointing out it was a different style of looking in to the call or to just to the numbers. But still, the overall picture that's given here. Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, I want to pick up on John's point and also Valerie's. I think they both really raise valid points here about the Democrats. And you know, why haven't we seen legislation? Because they're afraid. They don't want to get on the wrong side of this issue. I think people were surprised when they found out that, not overwhelmingly, but marginally, Americans said, well, if you have to sacrifice a little civil liberties to keep an eye on these terrorists, that's what you have to do.
And they're saying that again today, Jack. The latest poll, low 60% of Americans support this new program.
I'm not surprised, and I think that goes right to what Valerie is saying here, that Bush, that the Democrats, you know, when you look at him against the opposition, against the cravenness of the Democrats, that they won't even stand up for something because the polls are, it's unpopular, I think that says a lot, and I think it reveals, really, one of the things that has kept, I note in the polls, for example, that John Kerry and Al Gore are both rated lower than Mr. Bush.
Of course, they're not, famously, president. Let's take a call from Cincinnati, Ohio. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
Well, what do you think? What do you know?
Well, my question to this is, I'm 34 years old, so I don't really remember a whole lot about the Nixon, you know.
Yeah, that's ancient history. Okay.
But my question is, just looking at it from a point of view, seems like by the time Carter was elected, everybody was tired of Republican rule. So they voted in Carter, and we all know how that, you know, went. My question to the Democrats or in an independent is, what are you going to do in the next election? If you're afraid to say, hey, this is wrong or this is not the way things should be, why isn't that happening? And are you going to give me somebody that's not going to get smeared like Mondale or even Kerry for that matter or Dukakis? Give us somebody who's going to do something, you know, in a war with Iran. I mean, come on.
Well, let us pick it up, Matt, in Cincinnati. And thanks for your call. EJ, what about the Democrats here? Jack's chastising them for not standing up. At these poll numbers, when the president's approval rating is this low, do they get braver, or do they just ride the sort of backdraft of his unpopularity and try and ride that to victory in the midterms?
Well, I wrote a book a few years back called Stand Up, Fight Back, which was subtitled Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. So I understand what Jack is saying.
Yeah.
I get his point. I think there are a couple of things here. One is that, yes, it's just a fact of life, it's human nature, that when a president is sitting at 60% in the polls, the opposition is a lot more timid than when the president is sitting at 31 or even 29% in the polls. And so I think you saw this morning when the news, after the news had broken about this data mining program, that there was a lot more strength in the challenge to this program. Senator Dianne Feinstein is a good example. She is basically a moderate, very moderate sort of liberal. She had said that she was actually quite sympathetic to Mr. Hayden's, General Hayden's nomination as head of the CIA, and she turned around and said, this raises a real problem. She called it a growing impediment to his nomination. So on that front, I think you will see, you have seen and will see more challenge to the president. In terms of the agenda for the next time, I think it's very important for Democrats not simply to come up with one or two or three or five agenda items. I think it's very important to challenge the whole underlying philosophy that Republicans have been governing on. And it's been this very odd and, I think, contradictory mix of radical individualism on the one side, overlaid on a certain style of religiosity on the other side. Mm. And I think there is a quest for a different philosophy that is very much, say, a Truman-Roosevelt philosophy updated for our times, rooted in a notion of the common good, not a radical individualism, but an individualism that also sees all of us implicated in each other's problems and that our well-being depends on doing well collectively and not just individually. And so I think Democrats need to stop being afraid of philosophical arguments.
Kind of in this boat together. John Fund, our time grows short. You said the president's going to have to bring his base back if he's going to pull it out for the Republicans this fall. If George Bush holds tight to his instincts and his base, what would that mean in big policy terms for the remaining 1,000 days?
Well, I'll just speak until November because I don't see much further beyond that easily. I will say the president can do some things. I think he can very much move forward on the judges that he has appointed. That is one thing that unites almost all elements of the Republican base, with the exception of a few Northeastern moderates. Almost every Republican senator has voted for every Bush judge, and they generally get high marks from the ABA as well. I think the president also needs to move forward on some issues relating to spending. I think he has to veto some legislation or block some spending. I think he has to lay out a program as to what he's going to do in order to reduce the deficit. And clearly, I think he has to do a better job of selling the economy, because I understand EJ's connection between higher military spending, fighting a war in Iraq, and cutting taxes at the same time. That does create budget pressures. But if you look at the economy in isolation, I don't think it is at all questioned that the 2003 tax cuts have led to a rush of business and capital investment, which have kept this economy afloat.
Well,
you can't look at the numbers and come up with any other consideration. So the president I think, extend the tax cuts, and I think further make an argument that the economic policy is going to be extended into the future beyond 2008.
John, we've got it. And then there's the question, will that work when support goes so low? Has he lost something fundamental here? We will all be watching, I'm sure. John Fund at the Wall Street Journal and E.J. Dionne at the Brookings Institution, columnist for the Washington Post. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Jack, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.